Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Lisa, what's been coming up for you?
I'm really interested in what was talked about. Well, let's just start this way. In the 1990s, in an issue of Lancet magazine, or Lancet journal, the peer-reviewed journal, it was an article came out that suggested that it's not necessary to actually be near death in order to have a near-death experience. And I think that may be of interest to your listeners, because a lot of reaction is sort of like, gosh, you have to, yeah, you get near death and then you have this amazing experience that changes your life. I want to have one of those, but I don't want to die. And right. I imagine, Tom, you felt maybe some of that as you've been reading near death experiences. And so that's sort of an issue for further exploration, is how can we have this kind of experience that internally we feel like we have touched God and we can experience what the plan is for our life, which I think is sort of what Jeff is saying he experienced, and what many people experience is, I now feel like I fit into some big part of the plan, like my choices matter, and I'm not afraid of death. I think those are the basic things people take.
I don't know how it happened, but somehow I feel that way. I somehow feel that somehow by proxy, I can't, you know, I actually wrote a blog post this week in preparation for the podcast, you know, how to, and now the word has escaped me. What's the word when you do something vicariously? How to vicariously experience a near-death? How I have vicariously experienced a near-death experience. I don't know how it happens, but I have many of the partial effects of a near-death experience. But Dan, you wanted to talk about some of the explanations of a near-death experience.
I do. Let me jump in with one thing, though. And Jeff, I didn't want to make it sound like I was challenging on the theological level. So this maybe is a hybrid between what Lisa says, that you can have near-death experiences without being near death, or at least suggesting that, and sort of what you're saying, Tom, you've vicariously somehow gotten to these things. I guess all I want to say is, Jeff, when you were talking about the perfection of, you know, whatever happens, it's fine, we co-created it, we're honored for going through it. Without having a near-death experience, some of my spiritual experiences in life have landed me exactly there. In fact, my biggest trigger, probably my biggest first spiritual experience, happened exactly that way, as I was pondering my wayward days as a young person. I, you know, was nearly 24 when I went on my mission, and I was pondering my patriarchal blessing that's basically saying God gave me all these experiences for my good, and I'm going, what the heck's going on? And I somehow went into a deep realm of just it being told to me and sort of conveyed to me that everything was perfect, even though I'd missed all these opportunities and I had been so mean and, you know, lashing out and all these different things, and yet it was perfect, and yet I didn't get the same sense. And again, this is where the theological trigger that I was having with your experience was, I didn't get the sense that it was predetermined so much as it's simply, that's just how the universe works, is that it all works towards our good at all times, and even though I don't think the predetermination works. You know what I mean? I don't think it was mapped out ahead of time that, you know, you and Tamara would be in this car with your boys on such and such a date and that this would happen. So does that make any sense? There's sort of a sense that I really do experience with what you've said, the perfection of the universe and what our paths, no matter what they are, but without the predetermination.
Yeah, no, and I actually agree. I don't know that anything's predestined, but it is perfect in what we experience, and the universe does support it. And that's the best words I can come up with. But I think you've had your own experience of that, where you realized everything is perfect and in order.
Yeah, and then the other things that you talked about too there, of again, you shared a little bit here without telling much, but after your experience of being, you know, you're in the car and you're in the pain and you're hearing Spencer in the back seat crying and all that stuff, and then the next thing you know, you're walking in a hospital and you're encountering the energy of everybody that you're meeting, the doctors, the nurses, the patients. You kind of know them in their wholeness, you know their struggles and their richness, and yet you're not suddenly going good, bad, ugly. You're just feeling their pain and their hate as well as their love and their joy and their struggles all at once. I've also had that. So again, with what Lisa's saying, and I think in some ways it's just what we're talking about here, guys, is just these are spiritual experiences and elements of deep, you know, moving past the typical day-to-day kind of consciousness. These are available to everybody, whether or not it's through a terrible accident or not.
That makes total sense.
So Jeff, your book was wonderful because I everything that you talk about there, I almost experienced except for the dying part, and you know, and the specifics. It's like you know that ring or that flavor of truth that you sort of get is what really came out. So thanks. If anybody doesn't have any, does anyone think have any more in sort of this area of experience and character of the experience? Otherwise, let's do a little bit of the science and what are some of the naturalistic explanations?
Yeah, I think any good scientist just wants to know how things work. So I don't begrudge anybody for trying to deconstruct the near-death experience because that's. I'm an engineer. A good scientist just wants to know how things work. And so, you know, when Carl Sagan suggests that maybe the near-death experience could be a memory of when we were born, and it sounds ludicrous to me that he really doesn't get it, but he's at least trying. He's saying, well, maybe, you know, going through the tunnel is coming through the womb, the uterus, and the light is the doctor. And it doesn't work, and it's not compelling, but, you know, you don't begrudge him for coming up with that. I would like to say my personal feeling about all the explanations. None of the explanations I've heard, there's explanations of deprived oxygen. That do some things, and we can maybe talk about these, about there's explanations of when you get too much carbon dioxide, what happens to the brain. A lot of other things. None of those are very compelling to me. However, it does seem true and acceptable and right to me that the phenomenon of the near-death experience is experienceable in a variety of ways, including entheogens, which are like peyote, mushrooms, LSD, hallucinogen kind of things, ketamine. There are many ways of experiencing similar phenomena, and I accept that that is a real and valid point. For some reason, I could probably say without fail, all the other more deconstructive elemental, this element is caused by this, that element's caused by that. None of them have I found in the least compelling or matching all that well what really I'm seeing in the near-death experience.
Okay. Lisa, anything from your studies?
Yeah. There are many compelling, actually, explanations as I look at it. For example, in 1997, was reported in the Journal of Near-Death Studies what happens to fighter pilots when they experience G-lock episodes, acceleration-induced loss of consciousness. And during when they experience that, they report a memorable experience that has many things in common with NDE visions. They see bright lights. They have a sense of being out of body. They have floating sensations. They have vivid dreamlets of beautiful places, pleasurable sensations, psychological alterations. They have changes in affect. They have euphoria. They have meeting friends and family. They have a real deep desire afterward to understand the experience and what happened to them. Even though it's not really a near-death experience, it's just an induced loss of consciousness.
I don't know if it's semantics. I would not say it's not really a near-death experience. I would say with all the effects and all the phenomena that if it talks like a duck and walks like a duck, I'm willing to call it a duck. Where I am not seeing anything compelling is when someone says, it is because of the G-force on their spleen that when we try to isolate things out and say, this thing is causing that. And that's what I haven't found compelling, but I do find exactly what you find, Lisa, that the experience is happening in a very many different type of ways, but I don't distinguish it.
It's interesting that it can be physiologically induced spiritual experience.
Yes, that is interesting.
Right. Same thing with the helmet that they can put on with the magnets, the Persinger helmet. They call it the God helmet, and all of a sudden you'll have a mystical experience. There's definitely some things there that can happen with downward causation that will then make you have these subjective experiences, but that doesn't fully quite capture it for me. How about, does that make any sense? Is that a parallel?
Well, the fighter pilots don't report a change of life focus. They don't report a sense of fitting in with the universe per se. So it's like they don't have some of the most salient parts of what we would call the near-death experience, but they do have the physiological sensations or the sense of where they are located out of body and some of the experiences they have recreate the affect, but they don't recreate the motivation. They don't recreate the sense of what I'm going to do with my life now that I've had this experience.
Interesting. Great.
Interesting.
Lise, what else besides the fighter pilot stuff that at least is worth throwing out there?
Perhaps one of the most interesting things that's been discussed about near-death experiences in the last couple of years is Kevin Nelson's book, The Spiritual Doorway in the Brain. He comes to it as an MD, and he received stories from some of his patients about their near-death experiences, and he began noticing that these experiences occurred in the borderline, as he said, between consciousness and unconsciousness. And that the physiological parts of their story actually matched up with being in the state of REM sleep. He says that there are three states of consciousness: wakefulness, REM sleep, and non-REM sleep. And basically that's all the brain does, one of those three. If you're not in two of them, you're in the other one. And then he matched that up with what he says is our imprecise point of death. We say death occurs at such and such a point, but really that's a conglomeration of factors. Much of our NDE research comes from studies of people who have experienced cardiac arrest, and the heart stops, but does brain functioning stop at the same time? And is a flatline brain where we don't really see any activity, does that mean that when a person regains consciousness, there isn't some flash of something that the electrical activity then, like a lightning flash, then puts all this back into the brain and gives it a sense that it now has a memory of something. So there are some possible explanations that have to do with what we don't understand about death. And if the person who reports the NDE actually was ever in something called REM sleep or in something they experienced during REM sleep, can this explain the whole experience? Most people will say when they've had an NDE, but this was realer than a dream. It was more real than what I experience in real life. And Dr. Nelson points out that our brains do really strange things when we talk about what's real and what's not real. We can actually be induced to believe that we have a third arm that is real and it's not there. Or when we lose a limb, we can believe it's really still there. Our brains believe in things that are realer than real that objectively are not real. So that isn't a compelling explanation for a true skeptic either. So these are some of the physiological things that neurologists look at to say, can we eventually explain the entire NDE?
Awesome. Tom, any thoughts on that? Jeff, I can have you say, well, it was realer than that. But let's see what Tom says first.
Well, I keep having the feeling that if you've read as many experiences as I've read, these things just come up short. And I keep every time I hear an explanation, I think of all these other experiences that I've read that don't fit that explanation.
Right, and now of course the scientists would say, well, if you can't replicate it, if it's not common to everybody, then there's a problem there.
Well, I think that there is an answer to the replication, and that is the demographic studies, that there are thousands and thousands, and there is a replication that you can repeat the demographic study. You can go to another segment of the population and collect another set of stories. So in a way, there is a repeatability to the study of near-death experiences. So when I say, well, I can go to another 10,000 or 1,000 or 100 near-death experiences and find five or six of them in which somebody approached, like the one lady that approached her brother-in-law when she came back and said, hey, I heard you in that other room, and you said, I thought she'd never kick the, oh, no, I guess she's kicked the bucket. I suppose I'll go to the funeral. And have him embarrassed by that. And you'll find five or six of those in every group, you know, where that's repeatable. That's repeatable research. And it's not fitting. But at the same time, at least we're trying to figure out how it works, which is nothing wrong with that. Except that the core meaning, which, you know, there is a core meaning to love each other and to help each other in this world. And to not worry so much about life and the things Jeff is trying to explain, that all is perfect, that the things that can help us get through life day to day, I think it's not helpful to just say, poo-poo, there's nothing to it. When it could really give us meaning and oomph, or a little bit of help and comfort day to day.
No one has been able to explain why people who have near-death experiences have knowledge that they wouldn't have gained otherwise. They have knowledge about family members that they didn't know existed, who have passed on, or of details about those family members they've never met, about details of events that are happening in other rooms in the hospital or even far distant from the hospital. No one has been able to explain physiologically why that happens, but that's the same problem we have with explaining any kind of, what's that called when you transfer thoughts between people?
Psychic telepathy.
Telepathy. Yeah. Nobody's been able to explain that either, but the telepathic parts of the NDE have never been explained.
Now, weren't people doing experiments in operating rooms where they're drawing patterns on the floor and things like that in order to have, in case somebody goes out of their body and they're sitting at the top of the room as often is, you know, what happens, it says, and they're watching the operation. Aren't they trying to get somebody yeah. somebody come back. Has any of those ever yielded anything yet?
No, that doesn't work as far as I know. It doesn't work. Because that's not what the near-death experience is about. It's about people and humans, and so they're gonna hear conversations. But it just doesn't work. We know it's been tried a lot.
So, if you're in this out of body state, or at least this marginal state, the architecture and whatnot isn't going to hit you unless all of a sudden, it would be like the least thing on your mind. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we just know it doesn't work, but that's my explanation. That's my model, my map, is that they're interested in feelings and spirit and love and human beings. And so that's the kind of thing normally the most impressive things that they report are those type. Not that there isn't, like Pam Reynolds recognized the surgical instrument her people were using. To me, that's not as impressive.
Okay, good. Lisa, anything more before we turn some time over to Jeff to kind of do a more of a snapshot, you know, narrative? But anything more on either science or your own takes on how you weigh the evidence?
Well, if we're discussing the scientific approach to it, it's probably important to reference two more people who are doing research. Susan Blackmore's dying brain hypothesis deserves some mention for those who are interested in looking at how people are envisioning what happens to the brain. And Sam Parnia at Southampton University believes that there is good evidence that consciousness is not lost immediately at the time that we say death occurs. So physiologically, he says there's some evidence for consciousness still happening. Don't even know exactly what that is, but that's worth mentioning as well.
And would you say, we'll give you all a chance at the end to kind of do your final where you come down type thing. But at least as a somebody who's studying psychology and who works with people and things like that, what percentage would you say is worldview and things that somebody brings to this that would make them more likely to really go hard after the scientific things versus the others?
If I'm not answering what you're asking, modify it a little, but the variability in NDEs is a hotly contested subject because those who are skeptical say the more variability you have, the more likely they're dreams.
Right.
If there's not common elements that you can count on in an NDE, then it's really made up by people. It's too subjective. So I think there's a lot of it that comes from our culture. We see and our revelatory experiences as we have them are very much influenced by our culture and what we believe the nature of relationships are and what we believe the nature of our relationship with God is and how we think the world works. What seems to be universal are some of the things, first of all, that science says they can explain, the fact that it's realer than real. And yet the thing that can't be explained is why people no longer have a fear of death, why they no longer have a fear of some of the same things they used to have, why they now want to do something greater with their life, why they feel like love matters. And that's relationship oriented, but it comes from a single brain.
Interesting. Jeff, would you mind, we've given bits and pieces of your NDE. There's one part that you definitely haven't, you know, gone to, and it was later in your recovery process where you had a really neat experience. But will you take us just quickly through the narrative of it, and especially maybe begin with jumping off on the science there? I'm sure you've heard some of the things that, you know, we've been bringing up as possible explanations. And how do you still soldier on with this was real, this is literal, and then tell us the story?
No, I would love to. I find the science fascinating, and yet, gosh, I'm just a kid that grew up on a farm. You know, I really don't have a scientific background, and all I know is what I experienced. But it, very much in keeping, what I experienced was so real. I call it super real. This life, this mortal existence, feels like the strange, foggy dream compared to what I experienced on the other side. The other interesting thing about my experiences is my two most profound things happened at the scene and then at the end of a five-month hospital stay. I was in the hospital for 5 months and had 18 surgeries as they put me back together. And I feel as if I did have one foot in this realm and one foot in the spirit world through many of those long months in ICU. But my most profound experiences were at the scene of the accident before any morphine had been administered or anything else. And when I say profound, I didn't go through a tunnel. Here I was in the mayhem of the accident. I knew my wife and youngest son were deceased. I was pinned under the steering column.
Well, how did you at the point was you just couldn't hear them where you could hear Spencer. Well, so you didn't know until you began to go into your bubble or whatever you called it, right?
Yeah. Well, what had taken place is that the car had rolled. I had set the cruise control at 75, and we were heading on I-15 northbound towards Salt Lake City, and there was heavy crosswinds. 110 miles an hour was the reports. There was reports of a pickup that was driving erratically on the road. I may have fallen asleep and dozed off, but for whatever reason, we veered right and I overcorrected left, and the car proceeded to roll not off the road but down the road, probably rolling, they say, at least 8 times. Now, I blacked out for a little bit of that. But I was fully conscious as the car came to rest, and that's when I heard my oldest son crying in the back seat, which was a relief. It's like, oh, okay, as a parent, he's crying, he's hurt, but he's okay. And then when I didn't hear Tamara or Griffin, it wasn't just a physical knowledge. It was a spiritual knowing. I knew they were gone. I felt their departure, and it was devastating as a father to be pinned. I couldn't see. There was too much blood and things in my eyes. I couldn't move. Both my legs were shattered. My hip was crushed. My arm was torn out. All I could physically experience was my oldest son crying in the back seat for help. And yet I was spiritually experiencing half of my family going away. I felt their departure at a very core level. But as that was going on and I was trying to comfort my older son, I could speak. And I kept telling him it's going to be okay. And yet I knew it wasn't okay. And as I was fighting for breath, I mean, my lungs were collapsing. I was losing consciousness. And then came the calm. In this mayhem, this hell of being there, pinned in the car, knowing half the family's gone and trying to get to my son, all of a sudden this calm came. And I didn't experience a tunnel, but I felt as if I was suspended in light. It was as if a bubble of light was around me. And that's when I encountered my deceased wife. I knew she was gone, but there she was alive and well in that bubble of light. And yet she was not necessarily calm. She was quite distraught. And she was telling me, you can't be here. You can't stay here. You have to go back. And that was quite a powerful moment. Because I got to make a choice. Was I going to stay or go? And I wanted to stay. There I was looking into the eyes of the woman I loved more than life. But I also knew I had a son crying in the back seat of that car. And yet in the thought of knowing I've got to come back, that's when I found myself walking through the hospital. And this may be one of the most profound parts of the experience, because then's when I begin to encounter doctors and nurses and other patients. Now, in physical time, people had arrived on the scene. One of the people on the scene was a doctor. They were able to administer some emergency procedures to me. They had oxygen in their trailer they were pulling. We were rushed to Cedar City Hospital and then life flighted to LDS Hospital in Salt Lake City. And my experience was there. So all of a sudden, and having said goodbye to my wife in a very profound way, I found myself wandering through the halls of the hospital. But I had no sense of time. I was just there. And as I saw the doctors, nurses, patients, I knew them. I mean, I knew them so deeply. I knew them perfectly. I knew their love, their hate. I knew everything they had experienced. I knew their decisions. I knew their motivations. I knew what had happened to them. I knew their hearts. That's where the title of the book comes from. I knew them at such a deep, profound level. and I had an overwhelming love for them. It didn't matter. From the heroin addict to the Relief Society president, I loved them, and I saw that they were perfect, and I wanted to embrace them. I literally wanted to embrace them, and what I also felt was this oneness, this connection to them. They literally were my brothers and sisters in a very deep, deep, profound way. And as I wandered through experiencing this and knowing this is how, and you know, this may have come from my religious upbringing, I don't know, but I knew this is how God was seeing them. I knew that that's how they were perceived by God, and here I was experiencing it in a very powerful way. Words don't do it justice, but I was experiencing that unconditional love for each and every one of them until I finally came to a man on a gurney or a bed there that I didn't feel anything from, and I found it odd, and I stepped closer to realize I was looking at myself. I was looking at my own body. And that was interesting too, because I had some profound sadness realizing that there I was looking at my temple. That body was literally my temple. And in my background, you know, these gleaming white buildings dotted around the valley represent us. It represented me. I was the temple. My body was the temple. And now I was entering that temple to have my experience, to have this profound gift of life that would teach me everything, this endowment that would teach me what I got to know to go home. Now, that may come from some of my religious background, but having had this experience and losing all judgment for people and seeing them in a much different way, I, you know, the words of Jesus meant more. You know, in the least you've done it to, in as much as you've done it to the least of these, you've done it to me. I realized that he didn't see himself as better as the prisoner or the beggar on the street, that he was them, that there was a connection, that we were all connected, and that there was this profound sense of perfection in this game we call life. And I don't mean to make light of it by calling it a game, but it is the foggy dream, and the other is the reality. Anyway, in entering the body and knowing that that's what I had to do, it was as simple as a thought again. As soon as I had the thought of entering the body, I was in. And then the pain and the grief and the remorse and the regret and the guilt and all of it came in a very powerful way, and months went by. But at the end of my hospital stay, and that's why I bring this up, I was not on the morphine. I was not on the drugs and things when I had the most profound experiences early on. And at the very end was about a week before I went home. I had spent 5 months there. I'd been through all kinds of surgery and everything else, but now it was time to head back home, and I was simply on some Tylenol. It was right toward the end of the stay. And that's when I had the most profound dream, and I'm calling it a dream because I simply went to bed. I mean, I went to sleep, and I was finally able to lay on my side. The injuries on my stomach where the seatbelt had come through me, and I'd spent so much time on my back, I had actually rubbed a bald spot on the back of my head from laying on the bed so long, and I was finally able to sleep on my side, and I drifted off into a very deep sleep, and I knew I had passed into that realm again. I was home. I was home, and that was the word for it. And I had this elated joy knowing there I was, and I was running joyfully on two strong legs and having this super real experience again that's beyond, you know, beyond these realms of reality. And in that situation, I encountered a long corridor, and I went down the corridor, and at the end of the corridor was a crib. And in the crib, as I peeked over, was my baby son, the one I lost in the accident, and yet he was alive and well and perfect. And I experienced him in this time as a baby, as he was when he left. I've since had dreams where he's come to me as a young man, a grown young man, but in this instance, he was a baby, and I swept him up and I held him, and he was as physical as he ever was in this life, except more so. I felt the light and the life in every cell of his body. And as I held him and wept in this ingratitude that there I was with him, I felt the light in my body. I mean, it's as if we melded together, and I felt at a deeper than physical level, and yet it was tangible. He was solid against me and me against him. And I was just weeping and in great gratitude that I was holding him. And as I did so, I felt a being come up behind me. And when I say I felt it, I felt the energy and the presence of this person that I knew was God. They were so powerful, so eternal, so wise, and yet so personal. And as I stood there holding my son, this divine creator held me. And we all seemed to meld together. It was as if our bodies just went away and I was all of it. And the knowledge or the understanding or the wisdom or whatever just flowed into me in a way that was like a download. And I did. I saw my whole life. I saw everything that had happened. I saw the wreck. I saw all of it. And I saw the perfection in it for me, that it was customized for me, and that I had a choice in it. In fact, one of the most profound things I learned in that instant was choice, because this person I will call God gave me the choice. He said, you can feel as if you've been victimized. You can feel hurt. I knew my wife and son were dead, even though I was standing there holding him. I knew that had happened months ago in the accident, but I still had a choice as to how I was going to experience that. And rather than being a victim, this beautiful being I was with gave me the opportunity to give him my son. He said, you can give him to me, and he will never be taken from you again. There was a choice. It was how I exercised it. The reality was the same. But my choice, my perception changed everything. And being in that perfect realm, I was able to kiss my little boy and put him back in the crib. And then I woke back up in my hospital bed, back to the pain and the grief of everything that had happened. But I had a new enlightened understanding, having exercised my will in it and having been supported by this fantastic being in doing so.
Thank you very much. Lisa or Tom, what strikes you either from that or what else do you have to say today?
This is why near-death experiences are so meaningful, is because they give us new information about who we are, about our relationships, about the nature of eternity and the nature of choice. The fact that Jeff's story has many cultural elements to it that might have been different if he'd been living in India and had a near-death experience don't detract from that meaning to him. It now informs every day of his life.
The near-death experience changed my life permanently on October 27, 2003. And I like to think of maybe the near-death experience is the invisible but ubiquitous phenomenon that is really affecting humanity and has affected humanity in ways we can't measure. Lisa referenced the Gallup poll, and I recall that at least 5% of Americans have had a near-death experience. And so I just like to ask or think or wonder if the near-death experience is moderating the whole human experience. So many, it's the invisible, ubiquitous, life-changing, world-changing experience.
In a universal direction. That's what's fascinating about it. We don't have too many people coming back with a near-death experience and saying, the purpose of my life is to now unify a country by force, to create stability on earth by taking away the agency of this or that people. There seem to be some universal values coming out of near-death experiences.
Great points. Very, very interesting. And very few people coming. And Jeff, maybe we can have you lead us into this too. Very few people coming out maybe some people change their religion, but it's more likely that they simply shift in a religion and the day-to-day and the duty versus the spiritual aspects of a religion or whatever. So Jeff, how is it that you stay Mormon when you know that the discourse on a Sunday doesn't quite come close to, again, it's part of the dream, the world, the fog world.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, because I'll openly say I have very little interest in religion after my experience. I have an increased interest in truth and in light, and particularly in love. And I think what changed for me is I began to see the symbols, the beauty of the symbols in my own faith, and yet in all faiths. You know, it's really interesting. When I stood outside of my body and looked at it, and granted it may be my background, that I realized it was the temple, because, you know, but I heard the words of Jesus, you know, in 3 days I will raise this temple, or you know ye not, you're the temple of God, and God dwells within you. And all of these things that I was experiencing as I begin to enter back into my body, into my temple, to receive this gift of this life. But I saw beautiful symbols in a lot of it. I love the service. I mean, what the church provides me, the Mormon church provides me in the ability to serve and to give to others is one thing. Also, the acknowledgement of our own divinity, the acknowledgement, I mean, at the tender age of 8 years old, I went through the process of baptism to take upon myself the name of Christ. What I never realized until I stood in the presence of divinity was how divine we are. And in that simple little ceremony, where literally I could claim my own divinity, I could claim my own sonship and remember who I was. Which we all have the opportunity. And when I say we all, I'm not speaking about Mormons. I'm speaking about humankind. I'm speaking about all of us. Because in reality, what I experienced is all of us universally are the noble and great ones that came here. We're all the anointed ones. And anybody who's in this life, who is going through this experience, I love the Adam and Eve story. I mean, in the highest forms of my own worship, and in the Adam and Eve story, which exists in Jewish and Muslim and even in some Native American cultures, this Adam and Eve story where here we are in this mortality, having come from somewhere far greater. And if I'll be so bold to say, in this telestial energy, in this low vibration of this mortal world, which we're told is where we live in the telestial world, we're offered religion by the ego or Lucifer or the devil or whatever you want to talk about it. And the interesting thing is, so many of us embrace religion on a telestial level. And that's where guilt and judgment and fear and all the things that push people away from any particular faith come into play, because it's being offered by a dark force, by the ego in a telestial realm. And yet if we look at Adam and Eve, they reject religion. They want messengers. They want a connection. They want true communion with God. And because of that, the universe or God or the Father, whatever you want to say, sends them messengers. And they know those messengers. They know by a true sign that they're real messengers. Now, you know, you might say, well, that's apostles and prophets, but it also might be the homeless guy that walks up on the street with a profound message that he says in his drunken stupor to you, that you go, wow, I've experienced things like that too. But for whatever reason, those true messengers, which you know are true messengers, only have one job. And that job is to teach you to commune with God through the veil, to bring you to those highest realms where you're truly communing, where God can whisper right into your ears what you deserve to hear, and it's only for you. It's your business. So we may accept religion on a telestial level. We may receive messengers at a terrestrial level, but eventually the game is to commune with God through the veil at a celestial level, and only then does the real learning begin. That's those are those realms where all of a sudden that telestial world becomes a foggy dream, and we begin to realize who we are. Even Jesus's message, he never came saying, I'm greater than you. He didn't come to show us how great he was. He came to show us how great we are. You know, walk on the water, Peter. Why do you doubt? Why do you doubt? Greater things will you do than this if you only believe. And so he came with this profound example of who we are. And it's incumbent on us. I mean, that's what I've learned, is it's incumbent on us to really step up and be the light. Here again, these words of Jesus, you are the light of the world, because we're the ones that will change it and literally bring heaven to earth. It's not about dying and going to heaven. One doesn't have to die to experience these things. You can experience it in your day-to-day life by literally getting in touch with that unconditional love that is the most powerful force in the universe.
Beautiful.
I think Jeff is bridging the gap to what do we do with these experiences that people have? What, other than simply marveling at them, do we take them for doctrine? I think that's a question some people have. And Jeff has said beautifully what we can do with them, and that is use them as motivation to seek our own experience with God.
Absolutely. Tom, that's clearly what's happened with you. Do you want to elaborate at all?
Say amen. And like you said, absolutely. Not much more I can say. Jeff and Lisa expressed it eloquently.
Well, I have loved this conversation, you guys. Thank you so much. And again, I hate to, like, always, I love it because it resonates with me and all, you know, but the themes that, you know, it's weird, you know, we're doing this podcast for a year and a half now, and these are the things that keep coming up over and over again, especially when it comes to the Mormonism stuff, is that this is a religion that has wonderful things that lets you think in certain stories and narratives, and it has a message about our own divinity and things like that. But of course, that message sometimes gets clouded over by the rhetoric and people who, you know, haven't either had that experience or they've forgotten the experience of their own divinity, and they've been caught up in judgment and guilt and shame and different things like that. And so Mormonism has the good stuff and the bad stuff, but it's like every other religion. There is a pointer towards something deeper. We'll bring up the Buddhist thing of the finger pointing at the moon all the time here. We cannot mistake the pointer for the reality, and the reality is to experience it. And again, we've brought it up here, and that's that these are not things that language can capture. They're not things that rationality and logic can do. They're not things that neuroscience can fully grasp, though, again, I don't think anybody here doesn't think that there's physiological things going on as well. So, anyway, I've just been thrilled to do this. I just go around living my life, I'd say for 15, 20 years, without a fear of death, though I've never had near-death experience, but simply comfortable enough that I guess I still entertain that if I just go to sleep, that's fine too. But on the other hand, I'm just have quit being exercised over, is there life after death? Do I have a spirit? Because I don't know, the most profound experiences of my life have all said exactly where Jeff just pointed us. So even without going through what he's gone through. Lise.
I was just going to quote Phil McLemore, who says, in theory, the purpose of a church organization is to guide us to an actual knowledge of God, but that isn't often what happens. And he says that our souls actually ache for graduate instruction in the mind and heart of God. He quotes Alan Watts in telling us that what we want from religion is not the doctrinal and ritual symbols per se, and not even the series of moral precepts that will help us have a better life. But what we really want is God himself. We want to be filled with his creative life and have a conscious experience with him. And I think that's what we crave when we hear about near-death experiences. That's what we want for ourselves. I think the most hopeful thing is that God wants us to have that, not by cutting off oxygen to our brain till we have it, but he wants to provide it in our daily life. And I'm encouraged that I hear both Tom and Dan saying that they feel that even without having the step-by-step experience of a near-death experience. Yeah.
Could I share further reading? There may be some listeners that want to. I put together a few links at my blog. You just look up Tom Hawes' near-death experiences, H-A-W-S. And I just put some links to the IANDS, how do you say it? IANDS.org, place where you can find lots of near-death experiences. And how I have brought those into my life. And a couple more links.
Well, thank you. Jeff, any final thought here? We've really appreciated you bringing and being so willing to risk as well as just to share such a beautiful level.
I'm honored. I'm honored to be on the show. If anyone's interested in the book, you can find it. Barnes & Noble carries it. It's on Amazon. It's available on Kindle and Nook. Deseret Bookstores carry it. Siegel Bookstores carry it. Lots of little independent bookstores carry it. It's called I Knew Their Hearts. And there is a website at the back of that. The most rewarding thing for me in putting it out there are the letters and emails that I get from people just like this. The near-death experience, I think we all have spiritual experiences, and to open up a place to share those and discuss them is one of the most beautiful parts of it. So I'm honored to be a part of your show. I'm flattered to be on it, and thank you very much for taking the time.
Loved it. Well, you guys, listeners, thank you. Please come and share your own stories, your own reflections. I'll make sure to invite these good people to visit the blog and respond with you if you have something directed directly at them. But I have a feeling this will be a show that will generate a lot of good discussion, so I'm thrilled with that. While you're there, thank you for any donations that you might make to keep the podcast going. That's super helpful and a big part of how things work in my family is to be able to get some of that support. So thank you for all you're doing there. Everybody, thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. We'll see you.
Bye-bye.
Yep, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.